Thank you for joining today's podcast, where experts tackle bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome, BOS, and discuss the implications of lung function for diagnosis and monitoring. Today's sponsor is Zambone USA LTD. Zambone is currently advancing its phase 3 clinical development program for the treatment of BOS following lung transplantation. Joining us for the podcast today are Dr. Shambu Ariel from Falls Church, Virginia, and Dr. Justin Rosenheck from Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Ariel.
Hi there. My name is Shambu Ariel. I'm the medical director of the lung transplant program at InnovFFX Hospital in Falls Church, Virginia, where I also direct the Sarcoidosis Center of Excellence. I've been a lung transplant physician for the last 10 years or so, and I'm excited to be here to talk about BOS.
Dr. Rosenheck?
Hi, my name is Justin Rosenheck. I am a lung transplant physician here at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. I've been a lung transplant physician myself for about 5 years, and I'm really excited to be here today.
In our first podcast with Dr. Shambu Ariel and Howard Wong, we talked about the present and future clinical directions of bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome. There, we discussed the current status of biomarkers as tools for early detection, diagnosis, and for the differentiation of clad phenotypes. We also addressed at a high level the role of lung function monitoring, such as FEV1 decline, as an indicator of BOS versus a biomarker approach. We also touched upon the importance of early diagnosis on patient outcomes and unmet needs in diagnosis and treatment from the clinician and patient perspectives. Lastly, we discussed emerging and potential future treatment strategies and the overall outlook in the management of BOS over the next 5 to 10 years. In today's podcast, we will take a deep dive into 3 focus topics. Number 1, the role of FEV1 pre-BOS and post-lung transplantation. Number 2, we will examine the relationship of lung function and quality of life in patients with BOS. And lastly, we will discuss how biomarkers can be used to predict the biology of CLAD or BOS. Let's start with the role of FEV1 pre-BOS in the management of patients post-lung transplantation with Dr. Justin Rosenheck. Dr. Rosenheck, how is lung function used to diagnose or monitor for development of BOS in patients post-transplant?
Well, lung function is tracked routinely post-transplant. We'll find that our patients' lung function tests will improve in the weeks and months following lung transplantation until eventually they reach a baseline level of lung function. We'll determine their baseline lung function as the average of the 2 best FEV1s, separated by about 3 weeks in time. It's this baseline lung function that we use to determine when patients are going into chronic lung allograft dysfunction. If a patient's FEV1 drops to 80% or below of best baseline function, we can start to diagnose chronic lung allograft dysfunction. If this decline occurs in an obstructive pattern, this is consistent with bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome.
Is decline in FEV1 the only marker used for the diagnosis of early BOS or as a predictor?
Well, by definition, the diagnosis of BOS relies on the spirometric decline, on the decline of FEV1. So yes, it is really the only marker we have now. There are a number of other clinical factors we can use to help us predict the potential possibility of chronic lung allograft dysfunction, things like primary graft dysfunction, infections, episodes of acute cellular or antibody-mediated rejection, presence of de novo DSAs. But yeah, right now, FEV1 is what we use to diagnose bronchiolitis obliterans.
Thank you. How should FEV1 be monitored post-transplant? How often and by whom?
That's a great question. I don't know that there's really any consensus overall. I think it's standard of practice to obtain in-office spirometry pretty much every time a patient comes into the office. That frequency can change over time as patients improve post-transplant. We'll see our patients, for example, weekly until they've started to stabilize, spaced that out over time to biweekly and then monthly, and get spirometry at each of those time points. Again, I don't think there's really a consensus. I know some programs will monitor their patients much less frequently, especially as patients get further out from transplant. I've heard of programs that monitor once every 3 months or even once every 6 months.
And how reliable are home-based spirometers for patient monitoring?
Sure. A lot of programs will use home-based spirometers when patients are using appropriate technique and when the home-based spirometer is calibrated against in-office spirometry. These spirometers can actually be very reliable. I've seen estimates of up to 93% correlation with in-office spirometry.
Sure. We briefly touched on how often and by whom patients should be FEV1 monitored, but what is the most critical period that patients should be monitored for potential development of BOS?
That's a great question as well, Jeff. I don't really know that there's any consensus on the best time. I think it's really important that we increase the frequency of our monitoring after patients suffer setbacks, things like infection, rejection, hospital admissions for other reasons, or development of de novo DSAs, for example. Certainly when patients become symptomatic over time. The ISHLT guidelines recommend monitoring at least quarterly in patients with known chronic lung allograft dysfunction.
In regard to high-resolution computed tomography, or HRCT scans, can those be used for BOS diagnosis, and when can they be used?
They really shouldn't be used for the diagnosis of BOS. In patients who are evidencing decline of lung function, it's reasonable and actually indicated to obtain high-quality chest imaging to rule out reversible causes of lung function decline. However, CT scans are not reliable indicators for bronchiolitis obliterans. CT scans can help us make a diagnosis of other forms of chronic lung allograft dysfunction, like restrictive allograft syndrome, but should not be used in the diagnosis of bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome.
Are there any other important imaging techniques to support BOS diagnosis?
I've seen some publications on using adjuncts to CT scanning for the diagnosis of bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome. Adjuncts such as parametric response mapping, which can help quantify the amount of obstruction seen in CTs. These are things I've seen reported, but haven't made their way to daily clinical use.
Let's pivot now to the relationship of lung function and quality of life. In general, what does the quality of life look like for patients once BOS is diagnosed?
Quality of life and lung transplant is an excellent topic. I'd like to go back and say lung transplant provides modest quality of life improvement in our recipients. Many of them have very disabling symptoms before they get to transplant. And with the transplant and improvement in lung function, their quality of life improved significantly for a number of years. However, that may be hampered significantly, that will be hampered significantly by the development of BOS.
How is quality of life typically measured in patients with CLAD or BOS?
So in clinical practice, I'm not sure how other centers do it, but at least in our practice, we do not routinely use quality of life measures. You know, you can look at quality of life measures in different ways. There are multiple quality of life measures that are available in the research arena and also in the clinical area. For example, WHO has their own WHO quality of life measure. There's a commonly used questionnaire or survey that's called SF36, which is the Medical Outcomes Study 36, short form health survey, that can look at quality of life in general. For people with lung disease, we can certainly look at lung disease specific questionnaires. For example, the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire is one that's used in patients with lung diseases. As far as lung transplant, there's really not a widely validated quality of life measure. And to fill that gap, just a few years ago, our colleagues from San Francisco developed a lung transplant quality of life measure that was validated in their population. And that might be something that we may start using more and more. But in clinical practice, it's interviewing the patient, asking for their symptoms, is more of a pragmatic approach that we take to see what their quality of life is doing.
So this looks like it could possibly be a significant unmet need.
Absolutely.
How does lung function, or FEV1, specifically correlate with quality of life?
We know this from, you know, pre-lung transplant or other disease states that FEV1 does correlate fairly well with quality of life. For example, you know, the more common lung disease, emphysema or COPD, as you can see, as the FEV1 decreases over time, the quality of life significantly gets impaired. Patients have more dyspnea, they're able to move less, there are more symptoms, and they have frequent exacerbations with worsening FEV1. And as a correlate in the post-lung transplant side, we do see that patients with declining FEV1 have progressively worsening quality of life with their decline in FEV1. That may vary from, you know, person to person, but in general, I think a lower FEV1 does correlate to increased dyspnea, as well as, poor exercise tolerance, and also increased anxiety and depression that are common in our patients.
And let's take the reciprocal of that and say, what would a clinically meaningful improvement in quality of life look like in patients treated for BOS?
So in theory, as BOS is treated, or if you can treat BOS and reverse some of the changes that occur with BOS in terms of airflow obstruction and a dynamic hyperinflation that occurs with it, air trapping that makes people very short of breath, they would definitely feel an improvement in their symptoms. As we discussed earlier, there is really not a widely validated tool to measure that. So if we can establish that come up with a tool that can meet that unmet need, I think we'd be able to quantify that better. I think improvement in FEV1 might be a tool in spirometry, but then improvement in symptoms or, exercise tolerance and mental health issues could be measured differently. And I'd like to also say that many of the improvements that we see statistically do not translate into clinically meaningful outcomes. You know, you can see a statistical difference in something, but that may really not make much of a difference clinically. And then that's something we probably need to take into consideration as well when we are treating patients in general.
Are you familiar with any formal studies that evaluate quality of life in patients with BOS?
Actually, there does not seem to have been much studies, and this is something that we as a lung transplant community should improve. Looking back as early as 2000, the year 2000, there was a paper published by a group in Netherlands that looked at bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome and quality of life. And what they found was people with bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome ended up having worse quality of life compared to the control group that did not develop BOS, which sort of makes sense. But they also went on to look and see, longitudinally what happened on follow-up. And, it was very small numbers. They had under 75 patients at 4 months, under 30 patients at, year four or so. But they did note that patients with BOS reportedly persistently had more restrictions and dimensions of energy and physical mobility and such. There was another paper out of Germany in 2007 that looked similarly at BOS and quality of life, and which kind of replicated similar findings, but again, in a single center study, small study, And then finally, the lung transplant quality of life measure that was, a pilot, sort of pilot trial that was done in San Francisco and I think it was 2019. So three decades, three different small studies, but really nothing that has, looked at patients over long periods of time. So we could certainly do better in terms of doing a longer, larger study for this issue.
Our last topic for today is biomarkers for CLAD or BOS. Are there any biomarkers that can be used to predict the biology of CLAD or BOS? Dr. Rosenheck.
You know, Jeff, this is really a great unmet need in our current clinical practice. There's really an exhaustive list of biomarkers that have been studied in one form or another in recent and not so recent literature. The list of biomarkers can be overwhelming, and they include biomarkers investigated in BAL, in transbronchial lung tissue, in blood, point of care testing, and imaging. And really what I think this speaks to is our field's desire to better understand this disease, its pathophysiology, and ultimately to move from a paradigm of phenotyping our patients using spirometry, where we might be catching our patients when they're starting to advance along the process of this disease, to a more nuanced form of diagnosis for our patients so that we can best learn how to manage them. Really, the current state of biomarkers helps us just see how complex this disease process is. All of that being said, there are a handful of biomarkers that are readily available. Some things that we can use, like BAL, cell counts and differentials, increases in neutrophilia or eosinophilia, and plasma levels of cell-free DNA that can maybe indicate some ongoing allograft damage. A lot of the other biomarkers that have been studied have been studied in small and single center studies, and really just as far as I know now are not ready for primetime clinical use. If I were to identify an ideal biomarker, it would be something, of course, that's easily attainable, can help me identify chronic lung allograft dysfunction as early as possible, would be responsive to changes in management, and can also help me guide discussions on disease course and outcomes.
Dr. Ariel, what's your perspective on the role of biomarkers?
Jeff, I think Dr. Rosenheck actually summarized it really well. Goes on to show how little we know about BOS and how little there is out there. And despite being dubbed the Achilles heel of lung transplantation, decades ago, BOS and CLAD continue to be the major determinant of morbidity and mortality in our patients. Unfortunately, we do not have any good marker out there to diagnose chronic lung allograft dysfunction, much less to distinguish the two variants that we have, including BOS. I think there's a lot of effort that's being directed now for this. We've worked with the NIH and are part of a large consortium on, chronic rejection study and lung transplantation. We've done some work on cell-free DNA as a marker of allograft injury. And what we've seen is as time goes by, as we either related to reduction in immunosuppression or development of CLAD, the cell-free DNA levels tend to slowly increase over time. So that may be a marker that maybe that's already in clinical use, and that might be helpful. But as of now, we do not know how to distinguish acute events from chronic rejection events. So that is limited as well. Bottom line, I think we are waiting for that magic test, and there may not be a magic test, but maybe it may be a combination of imaging, radiology, biomarkers, or plasma markers that might indicate or lead us to make an earlier diagnosis of chronic rejection. And then maybe there might be a variation in BOS and CLAD. So that's something still in the works.
Do you anticipate that biomarkers will someday correlate to clinical symptomatology?
I think they will. It's just the matter of finding the right one. For example, with some of the studies going back to cell-free DNA, again, when you look at acute cellular rejection, say, for example, a higher level of cell-free DNA correlates with, higher degrees of acute cellular rejection. So, if we could find that biomarker that correlates with chronic rejection, maybe the magnitude of that might indicate, for example, again, in imaging, say, for example, if you were to find a good imaging technique that can serve as a tool for looking at air trapping, maybe the degree of air trapping might correlate with the symptomatology in patients with BOS. But again, that's something in the future, and we don't have anything right now.
That concludes our discussion today on the implications of lung function for diagnosing and monitoring patients with BOS. Once again, we'd like to thank our experts for participating in the podcast. We would also like to thank our sponsors, Zambone USA, and most importantly, thank you for listening to this podcast.
At Zambone, we know the big difference between living and truly living. Since 1906, we've been committed to innovating cure and care to make patients' lives better. We are aiming to deliver medicines and modern healthcare solutions that allow them to get the most out of their time. Because at Zambon, quality of life means deeply enjoying each moment. Life enhanced.